is reconvened. For silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. In our second day of three of June oral arguments, last oral arguments before we recess for the summer. 02-0678, State Ex Rel Brooke versus Brooke, is it Greselak? Rieslak versus Daniel Bertrand. Jennifer Myris or Myris? Myris. Batting almost 100%. Jennifer Myris of the Boardman Law Firm arguing for the petitioner, appellant petitioner, Ms. Grieslak. Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Myris and I'm from the Boardman Law Firm in Madison. I have been appointed pro bono counsel for Mr. Brooke Grieslak in this matter through the State Bar of Wisconsin pro bono appeals program. This case, Your Honors, concerns a prisoner's appeal of a disciplinary action through the procedure of writ of certiorari. The issue presented is whether a circuit court loses jurisdiction to review procedural issues in a writ if the prisoner names the warden rather than the Secretary of the Department of Corrections in his writ. What this case boils down to, Your Honors, is form over substance. This court should rule that a circuit court indeed has jurisdiction to review a prisoner's writ of certiorari when the prisoner has named as respondent the warden rather than the Secretary of the Department of Corrections for the following three reasons. First, this court has long held that in the context of prisoner litigation, the pleadings must be liberally construed to allow a determination on the merits of the case. Second, where in a case like this, applicable statutes do not clearly set forth the party to be served in an appeal or a writ of certiorari, this court has liberally construed pleadings and procedural statutes to permit true controversies to be heard. And third, no prejudice will result from naming the warden as respondent in this case, in allowing a prisoner to simply redirect a petition for writ of certiorari in a review of a prison disciplinary matter. In sum, fundamental fairness requires or urges this court to decide that Mr. Grieslak's petition should be accepted and allowed to go forward. First, Your Honors, in the context of prisoner litigation, Wisconsin courts liberally construe prisoner pleadings to permit a determination on the merits.
I understand, counsel. My reading of the state's brief is they concede that. Is that your reading of the state's brief?
I would agree that the state concedes that, Your Honor.
With regard to the second, the statutes do not set forth who is to be named in a cert action, the warden or the secretary. Would you assist me in giving me what direction there does exist, or how is a pro se prisoner or anyone supposed to determine that it is required in this action that the secretary exists? What do you look to show this requirement?
Well,
the best you can give me.
I think there are many things you have to piece together to determine that the secretary, if the secretary is the proper respondent to challenge procedural issues, there are many things that have to be pieced together. In DOC Chapter 303, that refers to prison disciplinary matters, it does state that the warden's say is final on substantive issues in a prison disciplinary issue. In Chapter 310, which is...
So you're talking about in 303.767D.
Correct, Your Honor.
It says the warden's decision is final.
regarding the sufficiency of the evidence.
Correct.
That's the way it's amended now.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and it goes on to say, with the current amendment, that an inmate may appeal procedural errors as provided under DOC 310.083.
Okay. Correct.
So the first thing you're going to give me is 303.767D. What else do I have to look at to find this answer?
If you do follow through with the ICRS procedure, because you have challenges to how your hearing proceeded, there is in 310, excuse me for just a moment. I believe it is.
Is it 083?
Well, 083, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing the site right now. I believe there is a section in 310, I'm not sure if it's 083, that does say that the warden or that the secretary's decision is final on certain matters. And I think you have to read that together with the Smith versus McCautry case, in which the Court of Appeals decided that they kind of, in a backwards way, said that as to procedural issues, the warden's decision is not final. You have to piece that together to say that someone else's decision is final, that, I guess, being the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. The statute, 893.735, that directs writs of certiorari, gives the timeline that must be followed, obeyed to be timely, but gives no direction as to who is to be served. So I don't think there is a whole lot of guidance, Your Honor. I think you have to piece together several things and to come to that conclusion.
So what's your ultimate recommendation, that the prisoner has to be advised as to who to serve?
I think that's an excellent suggestion. This Court suggested that to the Department of Transportation in the Peterson case and has suggested that to other state agencies as well. When the adverse decision comes down, give a notice of appeal with appeal rights spelling out, if you had these types of challenges, serve a writ on the warden. If you raised procedural challenges through the ICRS, serve your writ on the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. If you're going back to Justice Bradley's question, if you are raising procedural and non-procedural errors, again, there's no guidance. I assume you have to serve both the warden and the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. But I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I think that would, help this state in furthering its public policy of allowing prisoner matters the benefit of the doubt in getting to the determination of the merits in their cases.
Should the entity spell out what is procedural and what is not in its findings or order so that the prisoner isn't put into doubt?
That's a good question, Chief Justice. I believe
if they can't figure out, why should the prisoner be able to figure
it
out?
It's true. I mean, I think when you've got Chapter 303, Chapter 310, you've got these, confusing procedures, why not spell out for the prisoner what issue should be appealed to whom? Why put that burden on people who are disenfranchised, don't have legal representation, and are making their way through the system the best they can? This court has, as Justice Bradley acknowledged, the state basically has conceded that in prisoner litigation, the courts liberally construe prisoner pleadings. And moving to my second point, this court and the Court of Appeals have consistently rejected hyper-technical rules regarding the naming of respondents in appellate matters where the statutes do not clearly direct whom a writ of certiorari is to be, on whom it is to be served. The case of Weber versus Dodge County Planning and Development Department, a 1999 Court of Appeals case, the court said that misdirection of the writ must be ignored where there is no clear direction in the statutes on whom their appeal or writ is to be served. This Court's decision in the Department of Transportation versus Peterson, same issue. A condemnation matter where people served, the petitioner served the state of Wisconsin through the Attorney General's office instead of directly serving the Department of Transportation. And this Court found sufficient ambiguity in the statutes to allow the writ to proceed because there was not clarity in the law. And in the Peterson case, the Court acknowledged that you do need to adhere to procedural rules, but talked about the companion rule, that if you're going to hold people to strict procedure, the statute must clearly set forth the procedural requirements for service. And they simply don't do that here. And especially, if this Court and the Court of Appeals has been willing to, quote, bend the rules with parties who are represented by legal counsel, have monetary, you know, funds to pay for legal representation, it only makes sense and supports the public policy of this state that the Court should allow some leeway in prisoner litigation.
Well, how do you get around the Kulicki?
How do you get around Kulicki?
Good old case, more than, well, not quite 100 years old.
Well, I'd first argue, your Chief Justice, that, you know, Peterson, Weber, in more recent pronouncements, decided to get around Kulicki. You know, courts have gotten around it when they want to get around it. I'd also point out that it is a 1907 case. Technology was different. If there was misdirection of a writ, perhaps that did cause some major problems in communication as to who was being, you know, what decision was being appealed from. But I think that line, Kulicki, and the line of cases that preceded it are fairly narrow on their facts, and you don't see Kulicki being cited in more recent cases to quash or deny, dismiss writs from going forward. You simply don't see it, and I don't think that case should be applied in the narrow focus of prisoner litigation.
Was it more clear in this town supervisor's case, which was Kulicki, who to be served than it is here?
In the Weber case?
In the Kulicki case.
Oh, in the Kulicki case? Was it more clear?
Yes.
Whom
I mean,
to
would
serve?
You have said that the statutes are clear, cases law was clear as to who to serve in that case? Serve the town, isn't it? Town clerk?
I'd say, Chief Justice, that is just such a simply a different situation. You know, the town clerk, a administrative ministerial employee, was the person served. Clearly, the person in that case who was served had no decision-making authority, had nothing to do with the ultimate decision being appealed. He or she was the pure ministerial record keeper and not a decision maker. In the Weber case, the court decided, in Weber, it was a condemnation case, and the petitioners named the, they named the planning department rather than the planning committee, okay? The planning committee was the actual decision maker. And the Court of Appeals in that case found that the petitioner could have deemed the department an agent of the committee, okay, akin to an agent. I'd argue here that with the confusion in the DOC chapters and the life of a prisoner, who governs the life of a prisoner? The warden, not the Secretary of Corrections. You know, the warden is the person who controls things in your life as an incarcerated person. And the ICRS process, you know, good as it may be for having an alternative route to settle some issues, is a vacuum to prisoners. It's a paper review. They don't have any connection with the ICRS process. So to not excuse someone from naming the warden instead of the secretary seems very hyper-technical in the context of prisoner litigation.
Iris, if I might, a couple minutes ago, in answer to a question from the Chief Justice, you indicated that the Kulicki case should not be applied in prisoner litigation situations. And I was thinking that sounded to me like a policy argument. And when I think about policy in this area, I think about the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act and the policy adopted by the legislature to attempt to stem the tide of prisoner litigation that was encompassing the courts in Wisconsin. Now, from a policy point of view, how do you get around the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act policy that was adopted by our legislature and say we should ignore the Kalicki case and we shouldn't worry about things like personal jurisdiction?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I have not reviewed in detail the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act. My answer to your question is that there are very few cases. You know, I don't know how often this has come up. This is not going to open some floodgate to litigation because I now, as a prisoner, can name the warden, you know, versus the secretary. I just simply don't see this as contrary to the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which was, you know, partially aimed at streamlining and narrowing perhaps the goal or the scope of prison litigation.
If you don't tell them who to serve and they serve the wrong people, you certainly will streamline litigation by prisoners.
You may until there's hopefully prisoners will communicate and get this clear. But I think the overriding principle is that this state has to balance prisoner rights to get judicial review versus the PLRA. The executive branch, you are the check on the executive branch. The judiciary is the check on prison discipline. And if you are an incarcerated person who is disenfranchised, to have that right taken away because of a technicality like naming the warden instead of the secretary of the Department of Corrections, it doesn't seem to me to be fundamentally fair.
Could I ask a couple of factual questions that I just don't understand?
Certainly. I will hopefully be able to answer them.
There are 5 conduct reports here. What happened in these reports, and what was the last step in those reports?
There were initially 5 conduct reports in the writ of certiorari. 2, Your Honor, were eventually dismissed. Mr. Grieslak dismissed one and did not pursue another one. With the remaining 3, each of them had gone through the ICRS process, and the Secretary had issued a decision based on the recommendation of the CCE, the Corrections Complaint Examiner.
Now that's what I want to get at. The Secretary issued a decision. Was that written up in a document?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes, I have not looked at those documents in a few weeks. But, yes, I believe there is something reduced to writing.
Was part of the document a notice of some kind of what to do next?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't believe so, but I would have to check the record.
I think the import of Justice Bradley's questions early on, if I understand them, is to pinpoint some regulation or rule or statute that says, Secretary has spoken, now you go to this court and you sue the Secretary. Have you ever seen anything like that?
I have not. I have not seen any specific direction like that. As I said, there's a general statute that lays out the time limit, time frame, by which a writ of certiorari must be served, but I have not come across a rule, statute, case law, anything that gives direct, specific guidance on the fact that you now serve the secretary or you now serve the warden. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that if you look in the case books, case after case after case, that the prisoner has raised procedural issues through ICRS and names the warden. And the state argued, so what? This issue of misdirection was not raised in those cases.
Counsel, that eased my mind when I was preparing for this case.
because I have a territorial interest in some of the cases I write. One of the cases you cited as an example of, look, it's procedural, but the warden was named, was Shimkus, Court of Appeals case. And on behalf of the court, I authored, I think, a unanimous opinion on the Nichols case. Now, both of these, just by way of shorthand, I'll refer to as the prisoner mailbox rule cases. Shimkus was a prisoner mailbox rule case, sort of. And Nichols then relied very heavily on Shimkus, which had been decided earlier by the Court of Appeals, but very heavily on that. And there was another opinion I think I authored maybe even earlier this year that relied quite to an extent on Shimkus. So if there is no subject matter jurisdiction, as the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals found, what is the effect of the cases that I wrote in relying on precedent, which is now in doubt? In other words, let's say if Shimkus, there's no subject matter jurisdiction, then it's void ab initio. And there are cases that say if something is void ab initio, a case is said to be, here's another one, coram non judis, when the court is in which it was brought has no jurisdiction to settle the dispute. A decision coram non judis is legally invalid. So here I've gone off on behalf of the court and written opinions that rely on what might arguably be legally invalid because there's no jurisdiction. What do I do about that? Where does that lead me? Other than to an interesting question. Do you have an answer?
My answer, Your Honor, would be in this case there is subject matter jurisdiction.
Yeah. Okay. But if there weren't?
If there were not.
What's the precedential value of those prior cases if they're void from the beginning and this doctrine of coram non judis applies, which says a decision coram non judis is legally invalid?
I'll just have to be honest, Your Honor. I haven't analyzed that issue enough to give you a thoughtful response on that.
No problem. I fooled with it for about a half an hour, and I couldn't analyze it. That's what I'm asking you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Finally, excuse me, Your Honors, there is no prejudice to the state if prisoners like Mr. Grieslak are allowed to name the warden or whatever remedy this court comes up with in allowing their writ matters to proceed, even under an apparent misdirection of the writ. The final decision makers in these cases are either the warden or the Secretary of Department of Corrections. So there is no slippery slope created where a non-final decision maker could be named as the respondent. We are not advocating that position.
Your position, if they sue either one of them, that's good enough?
That is our position. That it should be as in Weber. Misnamer of one or the other shouldn't warrant dismissal of the writ, is my position.
Your position is the warden and the secretary ought to talk to each other.
Yes. And that they most likely do. It's a record review. You know, there's no new record to be made. So I think that's reasonable. Number two, these individuals, the secretary and the warden, are named in their representative capacities. This isn't like a 1983 action where someone is being sued individually for monetary damages. In that case, certainly, you know, naming the right person is critical. Here, I simply don't think in this context it is so critical. And again, it's a paper review. There is a record that can be forwarded to the proper person, and the appeal can go forward and decide it. In sum, Your Honors, I would urge the court to rule that circuit courts do not lack personal and subject matter jurisdiction. pardon me, when a prisoner is appealing through a writ of certiorari and names the Secretary of the Department of Corrections or the warden in certain matters. It is supported by the public policy of this state. Case law and the statutes are ambiguous. We've got to give prisoners the benefit of the doubt in these cases, and there is no prejudice to the state. Thank you.
Let me ask you this question. If there were a crystal clear rule that said you want to challenge the Secretary's decision, you must sue the Secretary, and there was notice given to that rule, would there be any problem in your mind then about throwing somebody out who didn't do it?
Well, I think this Court's decisions on, for instance, exhaustion of administrative remedies is that precise issue, Your Honor, where it is very clearly laid out in the DOC rules and the statutes that a prisoner cannot proceed with a writ until he or she has exhausted administrative remedies. And I think it is crystal clear in the statutes, and this Court has thrown prisoners out on those bases. I'd be more inclined to agree with that position if things were clear.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Mr. Glinsky, Assistant Attorney General representing the warden.
May it please the Court, my name is John Glinsky. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing Respondent Daniel Bertrand in this appeal. Excuse me. The law for 100 years in this state has been that in common law certiorari, which is what we're talking about here, not statutory certiorari, the writ of certiorari must be directed at the person whose decision is to be reviewed. And since the law in this state for 100 years has been that certiorari lies only from a final decision, the writ must be served on the final decision maker. It's important to note in this particular case that this is not a case like Smith versus McCautry, where the petitioner did not know that the warden's decision with respect to procedural issues could not be appealed to the secretary. The petitioner here, Mr. Grieslak, certainly knew that because he, in fact, appealed. He filed a complaint on those issues and ran it up through the ICRS, the Inmate Complaint Review System, and got a written decision from the secretary. So he knew there was another decision, a final decision, on those issues. This also is not a case like Walker or Shimkus, where this Court dealt with the question of whether the statute of limitations should be told because of circumstances beyond the inmate's control. There was nothing beyond the inmate's control here. There's nothing preventing Mr. Grieslak from naming the secretary, Mr. Litcher, on procedural issues and the warden, Mr. Bertrand, on substantive issues. He was not disadvantaged in any way. He was required to do the same thing that a non-prisoner would do, and that is direct the writ at the person whose decision is being challenged. In terms of the law as it stood for 100 years, there have been only two exceptions. One is if the statute provides otherwise, in other words, if there's statutory certiorari, which we're not dealing with here. The other one is if the final decision maker no longer exists, in which case this Court said of necessity, then the writ must be directed at the person or body that has legal control of the record. But John Litcher certainly was in existence at the time the writ was served. The Weber case that was mentioned by counsel really is not an additional exception. All the Weber case really says is that if you have statutory certiorari, statutory review of procedures or of decisions, and there's ambiguity in the statute is to be liberally construed. That's not the case here. This is not statutory certiorari. We don't have a statute that needs to be interpreted. We're talking about common law certiorari, in which it has been clear for 100 years that you must serve the person whose decision is being challenged. And on procedural issues, it's clear that it's the Secretary of the Department of Corrections.
Counsel, on that point, on procedural issues, it appears to me that if it's procedural, it has to go through the ICRS. Is that part of the new statutory scheme?
Well, it's been in existence for quite a while, but yes.
Okay. Not so new. So if it's procedural, it has to go through the ICRS. If it's not procedural, it doesn't have to go through the ICRS. Is that correct or not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I asked, and I know you say that, you know, it's been clear for 100 years. I think of the phrase in the last case about cheese, you know, that cheese gets better with age, but sometimes cases don't get better with age because things change since 1907. And maybe what was clear in 1907 isn't so clear here. I asked one of my staff people to, one of my many staff people, to, that was supposed to be a joke, but I guess it wasn't, to check all of the prison discipline cases that have come down in the last year, since June of 2002. And the most recent one is, and I'm assuming that these are accurate. I have not independently verified these. The most recent one, I think, is April 24th, 2003, State Ex Rel Elkins versus McCautry. McCautry, as we know, is the warden, not the secretary. And that involved the ICRS. In the printed decision from the Court of Appeals, it made reference that it went through the ICRS. So that case was wrong then. That should have, if it was ICRS, it was procedural, and the secretary should have been named. Is that?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because we'd have to know whether in the certiorari proceeding the petitioner was challenging procedural issues or substantive issues. If it was only substantive, then it would be directed at the warden.
Yes, but I thought I got, because I wasn't sure about this, I thought I got you to agree that if it goes through the ICRS, it has to be procedural.
That's true, but just because an inmate goes through the ICRS for procedural issues doesn't mean that when he commences a certiorari action, he's then challenging that portion or that decision. He may be challenging still only the warden's decision on a substantive issue.
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it? If it's, I mean, even a couple of cases that are pending right now in this court arguably have a blend of procedural and substantive. I mean, how do you know that if someone's arguing about, I didn't get notice, you didn't give me the right notice as part of the procedure, or I wasn't able to call a witness, you wouldn't allow me to do that. That to me sounds awfully procedural.
Well,
and yet if the argument is made that you know, employees due process and maybe even substantive rights, I don't know how you draw the line. So I was trying to make it easy and say if it goes, the law requires that if it's a procedural, it goes through the ICRS. And you agreed with that. Only procedural goes through the ICRS.
Well, Your Honor, two things. One, in this case, there's no question that we're talking about procedural issues. That's not disputed. The question here isn't whether Mr. Grislak had to appeal the warden's decision to the secretary. Everyone seems to agree that he did it.
My problem is this. You know, I've looked at this stuff, and I'm confused. Because I thought I was getting the right answer in my analysis. I mean, because I thought I understood that if it's procedural, it goes through the ICRS, and if it's not procedural, it doesn't have to. So I thought, to pull up all the cases that say on their face ICRS was the procedural vehicle employed, because that would get us procedure, because if it's not ICRS, then it's non-procedural. So I had April 24th, McCautry is named, and it's an ICRS case. And then we have April 3rd, Hoppe versus Kingston and Litcher. Now, there was the secretary. So it seems to be going both ways. We have August 1, Tyler versus Beck, who's a warden, and that's an ICRS. And Freeman versus Bergie, who's a warden, July 11th. And
And June 20th, the case that's pending in this court, Schatz versus McCautry. And
how am I to know? I thought I had it all figured out. If it's ICRS, it's procedural. But now you're saying if it's ICRS, it's procedural, but who knows what's going to end up at the end?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is going both ways.
I'm just trying to understand. Okay. I'm not trying to get you. I'm just trying to understand.
You cited the Administrative Code, 303-76-7D. Now, that provides that the warden's decision is final with respect to sufficiency of the evidence. It's not final with respect to anything else. By definition, everything else is procedural. But the other thing to keep in mind is just because an inmate has procedural issues and decides to go up to the secretary in the hope that the secretary might reverse the warden, if the secretary doesn't reverse the warden, that doesn't necessarily mean that he or she is going to raise those issues in the certiorari proceeding. They may simply...
What would they raise then? If that's what they've contested, now, just like here, they've gone, first of all, to the Adjustment Review Committee, and then they lost, and then they went to the warden, and then they lost, and then they went to the ICRS, and then they lost, and then they went to the secretary, and they lost on procedural issues. Isn't that issue that they would then be taking to the circuit court? Am I missing something?
Well, you would think they would, but there are inmates who challenge substantive decisions. Some challenge procedural decisions, and
I mean,
they can't
get new issues, can there? Lots of time limits. There's 2-day time limits. There's 10-day time limits. This is really structured, so they can't. If all along they've only appealed procedural, when they get to the writ stage, which has to be brought in how many days? 45 days, or is it less than that in this instance?
Well, I don't know exactly the time. 45 days,
45
yes.
Days. I mean, now they can't resurrect something that they wish they would have started from the beginning that's substantive.
They can, because the time limit doesn't start to run.
Have they exhausted remedies? I mean, they have.
Yes, they have. They have.
If they haven't even brought it before the Adjustment Review Committee or before the warden or before the ICRS or before the secretary, you're saying they still can raise it?
No, what I'm saying is if they get a decision from the warden, they have exhausted their administrative remedies with respect to substantive issues. If they get a decision from the secretary, they have exhausted their administrative remedies with respect to procedural issues. And another thing that's important to remember here, and Justice...
Where does the statute say that, and where does the administrative rules say that, in so that I, as a prisoner, know what to do?
Well, as a prisoner, you would know what to do because the law in the state has been that the writ must be directed at the final decision maker.
So I have to go back to the 1907 case. Right.
Well, no, there are cases subsequent to that that simply cite Kulicki and repeat that. But
so I have to go back to the cases, and then I'll find directed to the decision maker, okay? Now, where do I find out that it has to be directed to the procedural decisions to one person and the substantive to the other?
Well, since the writ has to be directed at the decision maker, and the warden is the decision maker with respect to substantive issues.
Where does that say that? What statute, what regulations say
We're not
that?
Talking about statutory certiorari, Your Honor. We're talking about...
Where does it say that the secretary makes or the warden makes substantive or vice versa? Where does it
in,
say
In the Administrative Code, 303-76-7D, the
303-76...
7D.
What does it exactly say? This is a hearing procedure for major violations. 7, appeal, D.
I believe it says that the warden's decision is final with respect to sufficiency of the evidence. The other place it's clear is in State X. Rel. Smith.
Is that the only thing it's final, too?
Yes, and in fact, in State X. Rel. Smith, which was decided 2 years before this act.
Mine says the superintendent's decision.
Well, that's the warden. The warden is called the superintendent.
Okay.
But in State X. Rel. Smith, the court made it crystal clear. It said that with respect to procedural issues, because of the changes in the code, it was clear that the warden's decision was no longer final.
Well, let's step back. It said the intent of all of this stuff is clear. But right above that language, it says, hey, you read these statutes and they're inconsistent. In fact, in your brief, I think you conceded the statutes are inconsistent. You conceded the statutes appear to be inconsistent.
Well, the rule, Your Honor.
Pardon, the rules, rather, appear to be inconsistent. You conceded that, but now you say Smith has made it all clear.
Well, the court said basically that it was clear that with respect to substantive or procedural issues, the warden's decision is no longer final. That's the words of the court.
Maybe my question isn't clear. Let me try to do it better. Did you concede in your brief that the words of the rule appear to be inconsistent?
Well, I think what I was doing is indicating what the court had said, that the court had found that there was possibly ambiguity in virtue of the way the rules read that, but because of the revision in the rules, the court said that the intent was clear and that henceforth it was clear that the warden's decision on procedural issues is no longer final. And the only other one that could be final on procedural issues is that of the secretary. That's the only other decision that we're talking about.
My reading wasn't right on that Smith case. I didn't see possible ambiguity. What I was referring to is this is on page 74. We agree that these provisions appear inconsistent.
Right.
And earlier they said, although McCawtry does not cite any specific provision, this assertion may be based on sub A, a provision which we find difficult to decipher. So the Court of Appeals was having a little difficulty with these rules that you're referring to, difficulty in deciphering them, appearing to be inconsistent, but that they were able, though, to, as you say, strongly embrace what they think was the intent, and they said that clearly.
Right. In that case was decided 2 years before this action was commenced. I wanted to get to a point that Justice Crooks had mentioned because he brought up the PLRA. The present law and the PLRA dovetail very nicely because prisoners have to exhaust their administrative remedies. If a prisoner exhausts his administrative remedies, it takes him to the final decision maker. If the law is changed, you will have an inconsistency where exhaustion of administrative remedies takes you will not necessarily be to the person to whom you direct the writ, even though that's the final decision maker. There are some other problems to consider.
Let me just, again, for clarification, though, you, in the second sentence of your brief, you conceded, I thought, that on behalf of your client, that a petition for writ of cert should be liberally construed.
The petition, yes, in terms of whether it states a claim. But we're talking here about jurisdiction, not statement of a claim. We're talking about subject matter and personal jurisdiction.
But could I ask a question? If the prisoner had a complaint about substance and then went to circuit court and named the secretary, what would the department's position be?
Well, that the writ was misdirected. It's directed at a person who didn't make the decision that's being challenged.
So the prisoner is not safe always naming the secretary.
That's correct, because the secretary's decision is not the secretary doesn't rule on the substantive issues. The warden issues the final decision there. So if an inmate is challenging both, the writ should be directed at both. But this is not unusual. Inmates often sue 5, 10, 15 defendants. Directing the writ at two decision makers, depending on the issues, is hardly a burden. Two defendants would be relatively uncommon for inmates because they often sue many more than that, in my experience anyway.
Is it your position then that an inmate who wishes to challenge the substance of the warden's decision as well as the procedural determination of the of the secretary has to file two separate writs directed at two different people?
Well, no, it's the same action. You simply would name both and serve both. So the directed...
How does that affect the time limitations?
It doesn't, because the time does not start to run until after the secretary's decision.
Okay, so the time to file a writ of certiorari on the warden's decision, the superintendent's decision, is told pending the exhaustion of remedies...
That's correct, Your Honor.
...with the secretary.
That's right.
Where do you get that from?
There's a case that, well, actually, it's the Smith versus McCawtry case.
Glinsky, when the prisoner received the secretary's decision on these five conduct reports, what was the notice that was given about what to do next?
There is no notice in the Secretary's decision as to what to do next.
So the prisoner then goes to, I mean, what, is the prisoner given any guidance whatsoever of what to do next?
No, there's nothing in the decision itself, and there's nothing in the warden's decision that indicates either that you can commence a certiorari action. I can tell you from the number of cases we handle that it is well known to inmates that they can commence certiorari actions to challenge these decisions. There are some additional...
So if it's not in the... I guess I want to follow up. If it's not in the Secretary's decision what to do next, so I'm Mr. Regular Pro Se Prisoner. So now I got the decision, and I don't like it. Now, where do I go to find out what to do?
Well, it's...
What can I look at? What? Here I have this nice, luxurious prison law library in Westlaw and Lexis. What do I look at to find out what to do?
Well, I suppose there are any number of places. Inmates do tend to spend a lot of time in the law library.
Yeah, I know, but I don't mean where. I mean what rule, what case, what statute, what do I do? Where do I find the answer?
Well, you could look in the
language you put into the Westlaw search.
Out of law.
Well, if you look up certiorari, yeah, I mean, certiorari will get you hundreds of cases.
No. Now I want to file a writ of cert. What gives me direction to tell me who do I name?
Well, the case law that's been in effect here for 100 years, plus the most recent one 2 years before this action was filed, makes it very clear who you should name because it clearly indicates who the final decision maker is.
So if they can find the Krulik or whatever it is case, then they'll know.
Well, no, there's more cases than that, but just as a matter of common sense, I mean, in common law jurisprudence, you tend to, there may be some exceptions, but I mean, generally, you sue the person who you are alleging injured you. So if you get a decision that you think injures you because it goes against your interest in some way, logically, you would think that you would sue that person. You wouldn't sue somebody else.
Sure looks like the warden to me where I sit in prison.
Well, the warden's decision, if you're talking about procedural issues, didn't do you any harm. It's the Secretary's decision that...
They're all the same to me. They're all in cahoots, and they're all the same to me.
Well, they're not the same because the Secretary could overrule the warden, plus it could also modify the decision, could also have different reasons for his or her decision. So even if the decision is affirmed...
I know that because that's what the statutes say, that's what the... procedure DOC says, the administrative code. How do I know all that?
Well, it seems to me there's little doubt as to who the final decision maker is. I don't know who else it could be. I mean, Mr. Grislak appealed.
Where do I find that?
Well, you find it through the administrative code, chapter 310, which indicates that procedural issues can be appealed to the Secretary. And that is where it ends. So that is the final decision. And the code indicates, as well as Smith, that the warden's decision is final on substantive issues. So there's no question about whose decision is final on substantive and whose decision is final on procedural. It's crystal clear. I don't know how to be any clearer. There isn't anyone else who thought to be involved.
Let's see how clear it is. 303.76. Now, there was that code was in effect. It started in 1994, the effective date, I guess. And there it said the superintendent's decision is final. Now, that was in effect at the time Grislak filed all this stuff. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
But
what did
there was amendment. There was an amendment. That it was amended effective August 2000.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misspoke. That's right. It was amended because it was amended in 98, 2 years before this action. Right?
Well, actually, there was emergency rules, and then it was, as I understood it, maybe I'm wrong, amended effective August 2000 after he filed his petition. So, in other words,
the language that says the warden's decision that put the warden in instead of the superintendent and said the warden's decision is final regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, an inmate may appeal procedural errors as provided under DOC 310.083. I understand that that amendment was effective August 2000, that in part that amendment was meant to give direction based on the Smith decision. But that amendment wasn't effective until after Relock filed his petition. Is that
That's
right?
True, Your Honor. But there's
So at the time he filed it, he was looking at language that didn't say the warden's decision is final regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, an inmate may appeal, but an error under 310.083, but was rather looking at the old language of 1994 that says something different.
Well, I'm not sure what he was looking at, but he had the Smith
decision.
Well,
he could have been looking at the new stuff because it wasn't in
existence. That's true. But he did have the Smith decision, and he also obviously knew that the warden's decision wasn't final with respect to procedural issues. Otherwise, why would he have appealed it to the ICRS to get the Secretary's decision? It wouldn't make any sense if the warden's decision is final.
Can I ask you, Counsel, what the effect of the adoption of the modern rules of civil procedure has on that 1907 case or 1906 case, the Kulik case?
Well, I think it strengthens the argument I'm trying to make here because certiorari now can be a regular civil action. And normally in a civil action, if you're going to state a claim, you've got to allege that the person you're suing, the defendant, in some way harmed you. If what the petitioner is asking the court to do here were effected, what it would mean is that the defendant in the action is not the person who did you any harm. You couldn't even allege they did you any harm. You would have to allege, I guess, that they were somewhere along the way involved in the decision made by another person that eventually harmed you in some way. So it would certainly be a drastic change in the law where you could sue the person whose decision really didn't adversely affect you at all and ignore the person, not even bring them into the action whose decision you're alleging caused you the harm.
The rules of civil procedure require liberal construction. The new rules of civil procedure, is that right? As we refer
well,
to
yes,
them
yeah,
sometimes,
right.
1976.
Right.
And so to that extent, there might be some implication, the liberal construction to any pleading.
Yes, but we're not talking about construction of a pleading. We're talking about jurisdiction of the person and the court.
Did you have an opportunity to read the DOT versus Peterson case that's been cited?
Yes, Your Honor, but that was a condemnation proceeding and it was statutory. It really has really little relevance to a common law certiorari proceeding.
It has a couple. One of the things that I guess was relevant to me, I feel like I'm a mother telling her kids to pick up their socks for the 10th time, because twice in that opinion it says, at the very end and then close to the end, in any event, we strongly urge a condemning entity to include with its award of damages a notification of the process a property owner must undertake for appeal. Earlier it says, even without legislative action, steps can be taken to eliminate any confusion. It is a better practice to have the notification of an agency's decision accompanied by an explanation of the procedures that must be followed in order to appeal that decision. Do you agree that's the better practice?
Certainly in statutory condemnation proceedings where the statute doesn't make it clear who the notice of appeal should be served on, yeah, you liberally construe the statute to try to get to the merits of the action.
Is it your position that that better practice, though, should be only confined to statutory condemnation proceedings?
Doesn't necessarily have to be confined to that. But at the same time,
let me hazard something a little wild, maybe, that maybe it's the better practice for all agencies. If there isn't any clear direction in rules or statute, so that it's confusing and ambiguous, that even if it isn't the condemnation case, it might be the better practice
to accompany with an explanation of the procedure that must be followed in order to appeal the decision if it isn't set forth in the statutes or the rules.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, but that's not the same as saying that if you don't do that, then...
No, I'm just saying it might be the better practice, but you seem to suggest that would only be limited to condemnation cases. And
No, I'm not saying maybe it would be the better practice. I don't know. I suppose the clearer things are, the better they are. I'm just saying that that really doesn't address the question as to whether the court has jurisdiction or the subject matter or the person simply because an agency has not provided that kind of guidance. I don't know, frankly, how it really could be clear. To me, the law at the time this action was started could not have been clearer. It was clear to Mr. Grislak who issued the final decision on the substantive issue. It was clear who rendered the final decision on the procedural issues. I don't know how it could be any clearer because there's no other person that could possibly have been involved in either decision that could be construed as the final decision maker. So anyway, I notice my time is almost up. I think the court ought to give serious consideration, too, though, if it's considering changing the law, the ramifications this might have beyond the prisoner context. And if the court's going to confine it to the prisoner context, then I think you are placing the prisoners at an advantage because they will not be bound by the same rules as litigants outside of the prison.
Well, give me an example of that.
Well,
I know your floodgates of...
Well, I'm not saying they open the floodgates. All I'm saying is if the law were changed, it would mean that if you're a prisoner, you can sue anyone who is involved in the decision process. If you're outside the prison, you would have to sue the final decision maker, which is
that
always...
That isn't what the court needs say. The court needs say here that there is no statute and there is no rule that expressly states who should be served. That the best that you can say about the rule is that it changed in, changed after he filed his action, and that it appears, if I take your position, that procedural decisions are to be served on A, and substantive decisions are to be served on B. But in order to determine whether it is procedural or not, then the litigant has to decide for himself. And the only way you can find all that out is by going not only through the administrative code, which is inconsistent, according to Smith, but you'd have to go back to cases dating back to 1907, and you didn't tell me where I'd find them in the Westlaw. Under those conditions, why can't the court say that to ask anyone, whether it be the prisoner or whether it be a lawyer, it is unreasonable to make you figure all that out within this time frame, and that service on either or both is adequate. And it's up to the department and the warden to communicate, and if they don't want to do that, then put it in their notice and then hold the prisoner to the notice. That doesn't open up very much, does it?
Well, it's hard to say how much it would open up, but it sounds like what you're saying, Your Honor, is that the common law can't be clear unless it's clarified by rule or statute, and that certainly isn't the case. The common law here has been clear for a long time, and it's also clear who the final decision makers were.
But there are rules here.
There are rules, but they don't address who the they indicate who that the warden is the final decision maker on substantive issues, and the secretary is on procedural issues. It doesn't indicate who you have to serve the writ on, except that the common law for 100 years said it has to be the final decision maker.
I don't even see where it says that clearly. You keep saying that to me, but I don't see where it says it in the words. It just says the superintendent decision is final for major violations.
Well, Your Honor, you have to combine it with the inmate complaint review system in Chapter 310 of the Code, which inmates are very familiar with, I can assure you. And there it indicates that procedural issues can be appealed to the secretary of the department.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glinsky. Mr. Myers, Ms. Myers.
Just a few points on rebuttal. The state, one of the first statements the state made was that Mr. Grislak in this case was required to do that which non-prisoners must do, name the final decision maker. Number one, again, I think it's contrary to the public policy of this state to hold prisoners to the same standard as represented paying clients who have access to legal representation. It is not clear in these rules who is to be served in these cases. It certainly wasn't clear to me on my first, second, or third reading of DOC 303-310 Smith Kalicki. It's not clear. And absent that clarity, we shouldn't hold these people to an unreasonable standard of hyper-technical procedure. It's not proper in this context. The state also argued that we will allow, this will be a drastic change from common law if we allow this, the rule I'm proposing to go forward, because people will be able to appeal from people who didn't harm them. Maybe that's true in the world of civil litigation, where you have, you know, any multitude of parties who might have been the injuring party. This is the world of prison litigation, prison discipline. It's a contained, encapsulated world where the decision makers are spelled out in the rules and the statutes, and it's the warden or the secretary.
But you have to get the right defendant before the court in order to properly commence the action and secure the relief that's being requested, don't you?
I agree, Your Honor, and I think the answer in this case is to either give proper instruction at the time the adverse decision is issued by part of a notice and then hold prisoners to that, or allow a redirection of the writ. Get the proper party before the court.
What's the legal basis for that, though?
What's the legal basis
for that notice requirement? It's not required anywhere in the statutes or the case law.
No, it's not required anywhere, Your Honor, but I think the judiciary can and does take steps to urge the executive branch to take steps to make the law more clear. And I think that's within the purview of the judiciary to issue such a suggestion.
Well, usually we have to have a legal basis to do that, if we're going to order the executive branch to provide some sort of notice. You'd concede that. Are you asking us to do it as a part of our inherent authority? Is that what you're resting this argument on?
I don't know if the inherent authority would support that. I think it's a good solution.
It may be a really good and logical solution. It may make sense as a policy matter, but we have to have a legal ground upon which to issue such a requirement or assert such a requirement. We can't just do it. We have superintending authority over the lower courts. We don't have superintending authority over the executive branch.
Well, the court does have. Let me think about that for a moment.
Well, maybe it's contrary to due process to keep under the walnut the P, namely who to sue. And then if you can't figure it out readily or fairly readily, then you have to allow the defendant, the prisoner here, to sue a reasonable person. And it's up to them to figure it out, not the prisoner. And as a matter of fairness, due process, we can say advise him or he can sue either one of them.
I would agree with that.
You like that argument?
I like that argument.
Counsel,
I appreciate that argument.
Counsel, I understood your argument to be in your brief that the legal authority that you cited and argued in your brief was the Weber case. The Weber case made an ambiguity exception to the Kalicki case. And the ambiguity exception set forth Weber at on Weber is, number one, where an ambiguity in service requirement is created through the interaction of applicable statutes, case law, and the specific circumstances of the case, and number two, the petitioner reasonably believes that the writ was properly directed. That Weber, in that case, when there was the county, Dodge County Planning and Development Committee versus Department, that they said it was ambiguous because of the interaction, much like this court did in 1999, and Peterson applied the ambiguity exception. I thought that's what you were arguing in your brief.
I certainly think, Your Honor, that Weber does support the conclusion that I advocate today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers, and thank you, Mr. Glinsky. And Ms. Myers, I do want to, on behalf of the Court and the Court of Appeals, thank you for participating in this pro bono program and offering your time and that of the law firm in representing unrepresented persons. Excellent argument by you and Mr. Glinsky, and we appreciate yours, too, even if you're paid for it. That ends our hearing on 02-0678, Rizelek versus Bertrand. The court's in recess until 1:45.